It's Monday on The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us after your weekend. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're going to start today in 2016 in the state of North Carolina, in the bathroom. Yes, the bathroom, a space of basic necessity for nearly all of us. In 2016, the Republican-led state legislature in North Carolina, along with then-Governor Republican Pat McCrory, transformed the state's public bathrooms into a public battleground with HB 2. That law prohibited transgender people from using bathrooms consistent with their gender identity. Now, the law was unnecessary, discriminatory, and frankly, mean. In 2017, it was repealed. But what ended HB 2 was not a blue wave of progressive voters. It was not the golden intentions of red Republicans. What stopped HB 2 was green. Money. Cash. Dollar bills, y'all.
Economic pressure activated by LGBT rights advocates cost the state $450 million. From the NBA to PayPal, entertainers and companies turned away from North Carolina.
That's more friends at Vice News. And it's a pattern. American Airlines, Apple, Cisco, eBay, General Electric, IBM, Intel, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Nike, and Salesforce. They all signed onto an amicus brief supporting the Justice Department's attempts to block HB 2. But the NCAA delivered the most consequential blow when it announced it would relocate all college championships set to be played in North Carolina out of the state. Now, these corporate actions made a difference. In 2016, Roy Cooper defeated the incumbent Pat McCrory in the North Carolina gubernatorial election. And Cooper swiftly brokered a deal to end HB 2 and bring business investments and college sport back to the Tar Heel State. The HB 2 fight ignited a bit of latent corporate activism. Think of summer 2020 after the murder of George Floyd. Madison Avenue did not sit out this wave of the movement for Black Lives. It branded and marketed it. And earlier this year, some of the biggest players on Wall Street remained willing to mix it up in the arena of state policy. Here's former American Express CEO Ken Chenault back in March, speaking out against a restrictive voting rights law in Georgia.
We cannot be in the business of creating unjust and undemocratic laws in an attempt to thwart the will of the people. And so what we're saying is this is fundamentally un-American. Corporations have to stand up. There is no middle ground.
In short, corporate America has established a recent history of clear, vocal support of human and civil rights and decisive action to oppose state policies violating these rights. All of which makes the current corporate quiet about SB 8, the restrictive anti-abortion law implemented 3 weeks ago in Texas, downright deafening in its silence. Despite nearly 50 years of constitutional precedent establishing the right to abortion, SB 8 effectively bans abortions in Texas. The law allows private citizens to file a lawsuit against anyone who, quote, knowingly engages in conduct that aids or abets an abortion. Foundational rights are important no matter how many are immediately impacted. But it's worth noting that fewer than 1% of Americans self-identify as transgender. Still, a broad coalition of profit-seeking entities took a stand for transgender rights in North Carolina. And about 12% of Americans are Black. But a broad coalition of profit-seeking entities took a stand for Black Lives Matter. Nearly 1 in 4 American women will have an abortion. 1 in 4. But thus far, only a handful of corporate entities have taken a position on the abortion restrictions in Texas. For more on all of this, we're joined now by Scott Sonnenschein, professor of management at Rice University. Scott, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also with us is Emily Stewart, senior reporter at Vox. Emily, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so Emily, what companies have said something about the Texas law?
The list is fairly short. Initially, what we did see were both Match Group and Bumble, both of which are kind of dating companies based in Texas, come out and talk about the law, saying that they would create funds to help people obtain abortions outside of the state of Texas that needed them. We also saw a response from Lyft and Uber. Now, this is important because among those who can be considered to aid and abet abortion under this Texas law are Uber and Lyft drivers. So Uber and Lyft were put in a sort of position where they needed to speak out, and they have said that they will cover any cost for their drivers in the event that they are sued for aiding and abetting abortion. We saw GoDaddy, which is a website host, say that they would stop hosting a website where people could report people who are aiding and abetting abortions. And then more recently, we also saw Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff tell their workers that they were going to help them get out of the state of Texas in the event that they wanted to leave the state. But beyond that, the reaction has been, you know, as you noted, pretty limited.
Scott, help me to understand a bit about sort of that recent story that I just told about, you know, sort of from 2016 on, we've seen a kind of corporate activism on issues that frankly, you know, still are very much contentious in the public sphere. I think, you know, HB2 is a really great example of one that is certainly not a settled set of opinions within the U.S. Why sort of relative corporate courage in those cases, but not here?
I think on one point, I'm really surprised about the silence on this issue. But on the other hand, I'm not. I mean, we have seen in the last 5 years a trend of increasing corporate activism. Historically, that activism has been much about issues that are very directly tied to the economic impact of the business. But what we've seen in the last 5 years is much less of a direct connection. With this bill and the anti-abortion bill, what's really surprising about the silence is, one is it's counter this trend of speaking out. And we've seen so much activism, as you pointed out, with the racial justice in the last year or two, but also that almost two-thirds of people on surveys are indicating that they wouldn't even consider a job in Texas because of this bill, which seems really contra against the economic interest of these organizations. But the reason I'm not surprised is that, you know, companies have historically, they just don't want to touch religious issues. They really fear alienating any employees' religious beliefs. And there's almost a tinge of irony here because companies for the last 18 months have been talking about the importance of creating an inclusive environment. And this bill is embedded in a state that doesn't create a very inclusive environment for many people. But on the other hand, they worry about taking a stance on a contentious religious issue will create a divide within their own organizations around religious beliefs, which they also want to avoid. So they're kind of stuck in a pretty tough bind right now.
Emily, I'm wondering if there are particular corporations in Texas, right, who are Texas-based, who you would have expected by now to have said something, who haven't?
I mean, I don't know if expected, but, you know, the day I was assigned this story by my editor, she said, you know, look and see which companies are responding to this abortion law. And I thought it would be an easy task. And so I reached out to some big names, you know, American Airlines, AT&T, Exxon, 7-Eleven, Valero, Dell Technologies, Oracle. These are companies that are based in Texas that probably employ a lot of women who will be affected by this law. And a lot of these are companies that also have not sat out other issues. You know, both American Airlines and Dell have spoken out about Texas's voting rights law. So they have weighed in on other issues there, but on this one, they've been pretty quiet.
Are those companies primarily led by men, Emily?
Yes. I mean, that is also part of it. Dan Primack at Axios, one of the things that he noted is specifically with Match Group and Bumble is that they are led by women. And for women, this tends to be more of a personal issue than it is for men. And so, yes, like a lot of these, you think about corporate America, what the C-suite generally looks like, who the CEO is, most of the time it is men. And so there is a sense here that maybe male CEOs, even if on paper they support abortion, they don't feel it in the same way that perhaps a CEO who's a woman would feel it.
Scott, obviously corporations tend to feel things no matter who they're led by when it impacts that bottom line, right? And that can be both, you know, on this question, as you were saying about, you know, workers not even wanting to work in a state where that company is located. But it can also come from the power of social media pushing these companies who've had something to say on these other issues in this space. What would it take from a sort of consumer consumer or social media activism standpoint to maybe move some of these companies?
So companies like to travel in herds. They want the safety of knowing that they're not the first to move on a contentious issue. So I think if you start to see more of a groundswell of other companies speaking out, I mean, right now it still is too small to really create that. But if you start to see more companies take action, you're all of a sudden going to just open the floodgates. And I think you're going to see a lot more public activism and speaking out. So I think that's the first thing. In terms of social media, I think if you can kind of make connections on social media to the implications of what this bill is practically going to mean, I think it's still pretty abstract for people. People have a hard time processing and thinking about what the implications are going to be when it's just a law. But if you start actually seeing some of this law get applied and you have stories, really emotional and difficult stories of people being, you know, hunted down by regular citizens to enforce provisions of this law, I think that's going to create a pretty strong emotional climate that's going to make silence increasingly difficult for at least a number of CEOs. And as they start speaking out, other companies are going to feel compelled that they need to follow and take a stance too.
I'm wondering, Emily, about efficacy. I mean, again, you know, the HB2 story that I told is, you know, demonstrative of, you know, absolutely efficacious action on the part of corporations. That is, I mean, it is the NCAA rather than a change of heart that changed HB2 in the state of North Carolina. But, you know, we haven't, for example, seen the state of Georgia, you know, backpedaling on its voter restriction bills. So, in short, what difference does it make?
I mean, this is a space that I live in and think about a lot, which is that actually if American Airlines comes out and says anything, does it make a difference? But I do think it's important to draw attention to issues, to talk about these things, you know, but at the same time, look at last year, you got into this, how many companies said something about the movement for Black Lives, right? Now, does that translate to who they are hiring, who they are elevating within their organizations? Not necessarily. But I do think on this, to me, the big question is if companies start to see an impact here in their workforces, that it almost forces them to take a little bit of action. At the end of the day, if you are Tesla and Apple, you've opened up campuses in Texas, and suddenly you can't get people to go to work there. That's kind of, I think, when you start to see maybe companies take more of a stand that actually makes more of a difference. But I don't think there's harm in companies saying anything, but it is always tricky to know, you know, like you just pointed out in Georgia, that the voting law has not been, you know, scaled back.
Emily Stewart is a senior reporter at Vox. Scott Sonnenschein is a professor of management at Rice University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, Mexico's Supreme Court issued a unanimous decision that ruled criminalizing abortion is unconstitutional. The decision does not make abortion legal in Mexico, but it means that thousands of people who have faced criminal charges for having the procedure will no longer be subjected to prosecution. The court decision brings into sharp relief the continuing rift in the 81% Catholic nation. Polls indicate that most Mexicans oppose abortion, and Mexican medical professionals have the right to refuse treatment to those seeking abortion. Less than a quarter of Americans are Catholic, but Catholicism is an important aspect of the current battle over reproductive rights here in the U.S. as well. President Joe Biden is a devout Catholic and only the second Catholic president in the United States. And in addition, Catholics are overrepresented on the Supreme Court. 7 of the 9 justices on the High Court were raised Catholic, and of those justices, only one, Sonia Sotomayor, is among the court's liberal contingent. According to Pew polling from 2020, a majority of Catholics in the U.S. agree that abortion should be legal in most or all cases, but the Church disagrees. In June, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops voted 168-55 to issue a new guidance which could deny Eucharist to elected officials who support abortion rights. So, just how does Catholicism inform the politics and policy of the U.S. government and our neighbors in Mexico? Let's talk about that with Massimo Fagioli, who is professor of historical theology at Villanova University and author of Joe Biden and Catholicism in the U.S. Thanks for being here, Massimo.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And also with us is Matthew Wilson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and Director of the Center of Faith and Learning. Nice to have you with us, Matthew.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Matthew, I actually want to start with you just to lay out sort of the broadest possible strokes and acknowledging that there is some diversity across leadership in the U.S. church. But how does the U.S. Catholic Church understand its role in influencing the political lives of its parishioners?
Well, the church does not seek to provide direct guidance with regard to specific candidates and parties. That is not its political role. However, the church does see a role in a strong role in forming the conscience of its members, that is, giving them the principles of moral discernment to make moral judgments in the public square and to inform their values on questions ranging from the sanctity of life to human sexuality to justice for the poor, a whole comprehensive range of the church's social doctrine. So the church is really about forming conscience on issues and then allowing individual Catholics to bring that formed conscience to bear in evaluating candidates and parties.
Matthew, I want to stick with you for just one moment because you did lay out a broad agenda is the wrong word, right? That sort of, but that broad moral compass, right? All of these different issues. And I think in many ways, under Pope Francis, we have seen really that very broad agenda of Catholic priorities, foregrounding issues like immigration, poverty, climate change. And I'm wondering if the U.S. is welcoming this sort of broad agenda, or if this is a time of kind of emergent conservatism moving back maybe towards a more narrow set of social and political questions, or maybe social and moral questions that then impact the political sphere.
Well, it's a tough balance, and different members of the American church hierarchy have somewhat different priorities. The church's teaching is a constant. That is, all of the American Catholic bishops believe that abortion is morally wrong. All of the American Catholic bishops believe in the principle of economic justice and believe in treating immigrants humanely and fairly, and a whole range of other questions. The issue is how you prioritize those issues. Not every issue is of equal magnitude. And so what the bishops have had to sort through is whether some questions are more morally fundamental than others, and whether some questions permit more room for dissent among Catholics in practice than others do. Certainly, Pope Francis has sought to emphasize a very broad range of Catholic social teaching, from teaching on immigration, teaching on the environment, to including issues of abortion, including issues of marriage and sexuality. Some in the American church, though, have pushed back and said, look, we risk creating the illusion that every moral issue is of equal moment and import. And they would disagree and say that abortion is a more fundamental and pressing evil than some of these other concerns. So that's where you get the tension within the episcopate on what the social and political approach should be.
That's really helpful to think of it as sort of that priority ranking or that priority emphasis. Massimo, let me come to you on this and in some ways sort of draw your attention in the same ways that I was trying to understand how the U.S. Catholic Church understands its role in influencing the social moral lives of its parishioners, which is then meant to impact their political choices. In a similar way, how do you read or understand how church leadership sees its role in affecting political leadership in the U.S., particularly those political leaders who are themselves Catholic, like President Biden?
This is a very complicated question because on the background, there's one fundamental difference between Catholicism, for example, in Europe and in North America. For example, in Europe, Catholic leaders have accepted the fundamental secular nature of the state. And so this is something that is still quite controversial for U.S. Catholic leaders. And so that's number one. And so number two is this. So U.S. Catholic bishops have had historically a complicated relationship with U.S. Catholic politicians running for office, especially for the presidency, beginning with Al Smith in 1928, when back then the major issue was to keep a safe distance. For John Kennedy in 1960, all these issues, abortion, bioethics, LGBT issues, they did not exist simply. So issues become much more complicated in the early 2000s with John Kerry running in 2004 and with Joe Biden in 2020. Now, there's a paradox that we can see that U.S. Catholic bishops were much closer in their majority, not all of them, but the vast majority of the U.S. Catholic Bishop Conference was much, much closer to a born-again Christian like George W. Bush, or even to a president like Donald Trump, than to a very devout Catholic like Joe Biden. And so this is at the heart of this very complicated moment historically and also theologically for the Catholic Church, which in its leaders in the U.S. simply is incredibly divided, not just within itself, but between the U.S. and the Vatican, because we know that the Vatican wants to have a much more dialogical relationship with this administration. And so we'll still have to see how this will develop because it has just started.
Massimo, again, one more beat on this. Let's talk about the Eucharist, or as Protestants may recognize it, as communion, because you sort of hinted towards the theological here. What is the Eucharist meant to do relative to a parishioner, a Catholic, right, and their church, their body of faith? And is it routinely denied to others? I'm just trying to understand sort of this possible guidance, which we're expected to see this fall, and the ways in which it might say that if you are a political leader who openly supports abortion rights, that you could be denied Eucharist. I'm trying to understand who are other Catholics to whom it is routinely denied.
Right. So if there is something distinctive of Catholicism within Christianity, is something called sacramentality, which means that the access to the sacraments is central for the life of a Catholic. Now, among all sacraments, the Eucharist or communion is one of those sacraments that is to be received frequently, contrary to baptism or confirmation and so on. And so that's why it is a politically, culturally salient issue, because it's not something that has happened once in the life of Joe Biden, but it's something that happens every Sunday. Now, it is extremely exceptional for a Catholic to be denied access to the Eucharist. And what is even more complicated here is that usually it is for all Catholics that are openly, publicly in defiance of Catholic teaching, it's up to their local bishop to issue a decision that is going to be applied by the local parish priest. Now, in the case of Joe Biden, the problem is that there's no precedent for a national bishop conference to decide on this, because national bishop conference, legally, in the law of the Catholic Church, they don't have that authority. And there's one more layer, that historically, if there is a Catholic head of state whose public life or public positions are controversial for the Catholic Church, historically, it is up to the papacy, to the Pope in the Vatican, to make a decision on this. And we know that Pope Francis has said always that for him, Eucharist is nourishment for the sinful, faithful, all of us, and not a prize for those who think they're worthy. And so that's why it is so complicated. So here we know that if the U.S. Catholic Church follows the laws and the tradition of the Catholic Church, it's only up to the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., and to the Archbishop and to the Bishop in Delaware, where Joe Biden goes to mass once in a while, to make that decision, and not to the U.S. Bishop Conference. But we know that the vast majority of bishops in the U.S. are in favor of some kind of sanction of Joe Biden access to the Eucharist.
So, Matthew, we've been talking a lot about the leadership, about the bishops, even about the papacy. bring me down to American Catholics. What do you see when you look at the public opinion of American Catholics? Who are they? How are they distinct maybe from the American Catholic population, say 50 years ago?
Well, the church in the United States is definitely changing. First of all, it is becoming more multi-ethnic. It's always been multi-ethnic in the sense of being an immigrant church. But in previous eras, that was largely European immigrants, Irish, Italians, Polish, et cetera. In recent years, that has diversified significantly with an influx of Catholic populations from Latin America, from East Asia, from South Asia. So the Catholic Church in the United States is extremely diverse ethnically, and that certainly has been a demographic change. The other thing is that public opinion polling consistently shows significant differences between actively practicing Catholics and more nominal Catholics. Big partisan differences, big differences in positions on major issues like abortion, like sexuality issues, and other things as well. So there are important divisions within the Catholic faithful, but we also have to realize that the nature of that Catholic faithful is changing from an ethnic standpoint. The other thing that has happened since the time that Massimo referred to with John Kennedy is that the Catholic population has become much more diverse from a partisan standpoint. In the early 1960s, Catholics in the United States were very strongly Democratic. Now, Catholics in the United States look a lot like the very divided partisan allegiances that we see among the broader public. And in fact, Catholics who attend church regularly lean towards the Republican Party. So those have been some important shifts that we've seen in American Catholicism over the last 50, 60 years.
And is abortion the key issue that leans the church-going Catholics, maybe, or the mass-going Catholics towards the Republican Party, Matthew?
It is the single most central and fundamental issue that draws conservative Catholics to the Republican Party. That doesn't mean that it's the only question on which church-going Catholics agree or are aligned with the Republican Party. Issues of religious liberty, issues of sexuality also would incline them towards the Republican Party. They also, over time, have adopted more conservative positions on a range of other questions as well. But yes, abortion and human life issues are the linchpin that initially precipitated that realignment. And certainly that will be the first thing that most devout Catholics who incline to the Republican Party will mention as the source of their allegiance.
Massimo, I'm wondering about the ways that the Trump years, right, or the one term of the Trump presidency impacted this connection between sort of U.S. politics and, you know, both the Vatican and Catholic churchgoers. I mean, President Trump was not, you know, even an evangelical in the ways that, for example, you know, President George W. Bush was. And I'm wondering if we saw any growing rift on sort of all of these other issues that Catholics hold dear, you know, relative to those years with President Trump.
Yes, this is something that we could observe in these last few years. And very simply put, there is a very interesting overlap between a certain kind of political faith in the project of Donald Trump and of Trumpism against liberal issues on LGBT, on abortion, and on the role of the church and religion in public life. And so there's this overlap with Trumpism, with a certain opposition to the pontificate of Pope Francis. And so there is, and that can be tracked down in statements of bishops, of intellectual leaders, of lay leaders of the Catholic Church in this country. And so there has been, I would say, a strengthening of the political alignment between conservative Catholic bishops and the Republican Party in these last few years. So what has been shocking to see, honestly, is that when Joe Biden was elected, and his election was clear a few days after Election Day, the Vatican issued a statement congratulating him a few days after, at the same time when some Catholic bishops were vocally, openly questioning the legitimacy of the election of Joe Biden. That has been something that says something on how a certain extremism politically is taking roots among U.S. Catholic bishops and has frankly damaged the relationship with the Vatican and with this pontificate that was difficult from the very beginning, 2013, but it has gone beyond, honestly, my imagination in terms of rifts and ruptures and a lack of consensus, but in many cases also lack of basic manners in relating to the Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
Matthew, I want to come to you to talk a bit about the Supreme Court here. So as you were talking about being nominally Catholic versus those who might be more devout, you know, regular attenders of Mass, I am married to one of those so-called bad Catholics, or as I tease him. You know, Catholicism ends up being almost more of a cultural or a social marker, right? Having been raised in Louisiana and, you know, growing up in a Catholic household, going to Catholic schools, that sort of thing. And so when I look at the Supreme Court, I wonder a bit about those who were raised Catholic who are on that court and the ways that Catholicism might impact a wide variety of decisions, but most specifically around the question of human life, the question of abortion. What do you see as you're looking at those justices relative to their need to, even if they're not practicing at this time, really rectify their understandings of the church, of the good, of the moral, with what is fairly settled precedent for about 50 years around the right of persons to choose an abortion?
Well, certainly their consciences would have been formed by their experience in the Catholic Church, whether it's ongoing or whether it's something that was in the past. Of course, it is not their job to bring their conscience to bear in and of itself in setting Supreme Court decision making, right? Their job is to interpret and apply the Constitution. And as Justice Gorsuch famously said, he's actually one of the few justices of the Supreme Court who's not Catholic. But Justice Gorsuch famously said that a good justice will be someone who sometimes comes to decisions whose outcome he is not happy. And so the question is not simply what do I think is right and just, but what does the Constitution say? Now, that being said, there are distinctively Catholic legal traditions and modes of jurisprudential interpretation that exist in the background here that Supreme Court justices could bring to bear. But certainly, you know, they are not going to simply say, well, the church says abortion is wrong, therefore, abortion must be unconstitutional. Their reasoning is much more sophisticated than that. And in fact, it's their job to have reasoning that is more sophisticated than that. So, you know, the religious faith becomes a point of forming the conscience. But how that applies in the context of interpreting the Constitution is much more an issue of legal philosophy. Can I say one thing? Just you mentioned about Catholicism from Louisiana, and that actually serves as an interesting historical reference for our discussion today, because one of the famous incidents in the 1960s was the Archbishop of New Orleans excommunicating or denying communion to local Catholic leaders who resisted integration. And the parish leader, Leandro Perez, is a famous example of that. Now that, as Massimo suggested, that was something that was done on the local episcopal level. But that's a definite historical precedent in American history for a Catholic public figure being denied communion because he refused to, in a public sense, go along with what the church was teaching to be morally correct, in this case, integration of the schools. So that's a little bit of a digression, but having mentioned New Orleans, I thought it was relevant to bring that into the discussion.
Absolutely. And I was prodding you a little bit. I knew if I said Catholic and Louisiana, you'd have a good historical narrative or a story for me in some way. Massimo, let me also just sort of hand this to you and ask how you see Catholicism potentially impacting our upcoming midterm elections, or again, these core Supreme Court decisions that will be made in the coming days.
I believe that the most important issue we'll have to consider in these next few weeks and months is if the Supreme Court will decide other cases that are related to Roe v. Wade and to abortion. So that could have a major, major impact on the way Catholics are divided politically. Now, I have to say that in these the first 9 months of this administration, Joe Biden has not been willing to look too Catholic, I would say. And this is something that we could see also in the presidency of John Kennedy when he decided not to help Catholic schools, for example, and so on. So in these first 9 months, Joe Biden has not appointed yet, nominated yet, the new U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. And there is, I believe, a growing distance between Joe Biden and the Vatican, also because this radicalization of the debate in the U.S. on abortion is making more difficult for Pope Francis to help Joe Biden, honestly. And so we will see how that will go. But on the one side, there is what the Supreme Court will do with abortion and what the U.S. bishops, Catholic Bishop Conference, will decide on this issue of the Eucharist, because at their fall meeting of November, they should discuss and vote on a document of the Bishop Conference on this particular issue. And we will see probably another showdown among U.S. bishops. And I think there will be the usual majority of U.S. bishops in favor of a hard line with this presidency, and a minority that are willing to be more engaging, more dialogical. That will say something on what's next.
Massimo Fagioli is a professor of historical theology at Villanova University and author of Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. And Matthew Wilson is an associate professor of political science at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and a director for the Center of Faith and Learning. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being a guest today.
Every memory you think you have of the past,
the house you grew up in, your first kiss,
it's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This weekend, our country marked 20 years since the terrorist attacks on September 11th. We commemorated our shared mourning, collectively recounted all that has been lost, and continued to search for meaning in the still unfathomable events of that day. Here on The Takeaway, we contributed in our own small way to these commemorative efforts by hosting a live conversation with Amane Alkataba, founder of MuslimGirl.com, and Mona El-Tahawi, writer of the Feminist Giant newsletter. I began by asking Amane what she remembered of that day, given that she was just 9 years old.
I remember a lot, actually, as young as I was, because of how severe life changed overnight. You know, even though you are a child, as children tend to do, you become very sensitive to the world around you, and especially how the world around you is treating you. And for me and my family, our lives were just completely turned upside down by this tragedy. I mean, I was born and raised in New Jersey. I grew up barely 30 miles away from Ground Zero. And 9/11 happened on my yearbook photo day when I was in elementary school. So it was definitely a significant day that's like seared into my memory. And what I remember the most after our unscheduled early dismissal that day was coming home to find my family huddled in the living room around our television set with what was happening on loop in front of us. And for me, I was still trying to perceive what that meant. What do you mean a plane flew into these buildings? What do you mean the buildings aren't there anymore? And my dad turned and looked at our family and said, they're going to blame us and it's going to get much worse. And from there, truly life as we knew it changed. I mean, for me, I was suddenly subject to extreme bullying in school. I heard my first racial slur in my elementary school classroom that same year. My family's, our house in our hometown was being targeted by the neighborhood kids that would water balloon and TP our home and egg it. And my family is, you know, the typical immigrant story where we've run an electronics store for most of my life. And as soon as 9/11 happened, the rest of the vendors in the flea market building where my family had their business band together to launch a petition to kick all of the Muslim businesses out of that building. So it was very significant. It was very trying, and it instilled a lot of fear into my young family. And I think that our story is among the most privileged of experiences immediately post 9/11.
Amani is American by birth and was still a child 20 years ago. But Mona El-Tahawi was an adult on 9/11. And she was a newly arrived immigrant from Egypt. Her recollections bring into full view just how dangerous the days after 9/11 were for Muslims in America.
I had moved to the United States the year before 9/11. I married an American, and we were living in Seattle at the time of the attacks. My brother and his wife were visiting us. And I remember the phone rang at 6 a.m. It just would not stop ringing. And it was my late ex-mother-in-law, because I'm now divorced and she has passed. And I picked up the phone and she said, turn the television on, turn the television on. Something terrible is happening in New York. The towers are falling. We turned the TV on. I ran upstairs to wake up my brother and his sister. And I remember I turned to them and I said to them, if this is Muslims, they're going to round us up. We're going to be put in camps. I was terrified. And we did not leave the house for 2 days because my sister-in-law wore a headscarf. And we were really worried about her. We were in Seattle, which is supposedly this progressive, you know, liberal city. But we were really worried about her. And our worries were not unfounded because just a couple of days after 9/11, a man tried to set our local mosque on fire in Seattle. He was too drunk, and two Muslim men coming out of congregational prayers tried to stop him as he was pouring gasoline on the, you know, near the mosque grounds, and he tried to shoot them. And, you know, that, like I said, our fears were not unfounded, but soon after this failed arson attempt, the neighborhood around the mosque, not Muslims, but the non-Muslims around the mosque, flooded the door of the mosque with bouquets of flowers, because my now ex-husband drove us to the mosque to make sure everyone was okay. And there were just flowers everywhere and notes of support from the people in the neighborhood. And for the next 2 months, there were two people from those neighbors around the mosque standing guard outside the mosque every day, holding up signs saying Muslims are Americans to protect the mosque. So that was September of 2001. And, you know, you mentioned the attacks against Muslims, and, you know, we talked about visibly Muslim women. I had a Muslim friend, a Muslim woman friend at the time, who, like me, does not wear a headscarf. She is visibly, well, she's brown. So I don't think that these racists could tell that she was South Asian. But she was leaving a restaurant in Seattle, again, you know, liberal, progressive Seattle, when a group of white men shouted at her white husband, what does it feel like to f*** a terrorist? So, you know, anyone who did not look white, anyone who was suspected, quote unquote, of being a Muslim, was being targeted for hate.
While both Amani and Mona had firsthand experiences of Islamophobic bias, bullying, and violence by individuals in the weeks and months following 9/11, both women insisted we should focus on official policies rather than interpersonal attacks. Amani began by reminding our audience of the National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, or NSEERS, which was enacted in the months following 9/11.
NSEERS program, which came to be during the War on Terror and still existed under Obama, was an actual nationwide database of Muslim men from a list of Muslim countries that we kept here, right? Like literally only men from specific Muslim countries, never mind the fact that Muslims come from every walk of life on the planet and every country on the planet, right? But this existed years before Trump's Muslim ban even became part of the conversation. Similarly, we still have the Patriot Act, which basically eliminates our due process rights as long as we come from our Muslim faith, and somehow there's an accusation of terrorism there, even if not a single charge comes on you. But the Patriot Act allowed such invasive surveillance to take place within the Muslim community And if we want to talk about feminism, let's talk about how Muslim women have been impacted by watching their fathers, brothers, husbands get abducted from the safety of their homes with no explanation and many times to never be seen again. These things have been, they happened immediately after 9/11 and they're still happening. Those policies are still in place. And that's what we should be focusing on. Like especially now that like I'm in my 20s, I'm sick and tired of having spent my entire life talking about Muslim women. No, let's actually talk about what's really important here and why we're allowing this treatment to take place within this time period right now. It's 2021.
Also emphasizing the structural, institutional, and political violence of post 9/11 federal policy, Mona El-Tahawi recounted how these government practices affected her family.
My brother was one of those Muslim men who had to submit to what this program called special registration. He and his Muslim friends, because it was a list of 25 countries and 24 of those countries were mostly in the so-called Arab world. And they had to have their pictures taken, they had to be fingerprinted, and they were put into a special registry. They couldn't move without checking in with the FBI. They couldn't leave the country without getting security clearance. My brother did not leave the United States for 10 years straight because he was worried that he would lose his student visa and his work and his income, because several of his Muslim friends did. And I talked about how we were together in Seattle when the 9/11 attacks happened and a man unsuccessfully tried to set my local mosque on fire. That same brother of mine lives in the Midwest, where he submitted to so-called special registration. And an arsonist actually succeeded in setting his mosque on fire in 2012. So that's 11 years after the 9/11 attacks. My nieces and nephews were in that mosque just hours before it was gutted by a fire by a man who said that he had watched Fox News, and Fox News had told him that, or he learned from Fox News, that Muslims were killing Americans around the world and he wanted to fight back and teach Muslims a lesson. And so he set a mosque in the Midwest on fire. So that mosque took a while, you know, they fundraised and they rebuilt again. And I'm bringing it up, not just to talk about how it was set on fire, as many other mosques around the country were set on fire. I refuse to allow my nieces and nephews to grow up in a country where being Muslim, where being brown, and being Egyptian is going to be used against them for something they had nothing to do with. Their father was visited by the FBI a month after 9/11 and by a special agent and asked, do you know anyone who celebrated 9/11? What the actual hell, you know, and had to be subjected to this special registration. So enough.
As our conversation continued, we moved away from the immediate post 9/11 moment and considered a broader sweep of global and domestic experiences. I asked Mona about her reactions to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
Melissa, it has been incredible, and I don't mean it in a good way. I mean, incredulous maybe, to watch the reaction following the insurrection, following January 6th. And, you know, I want to tie that to what also happened in Texas with the abortion case, with the election of Trump, and with the growing boldness of white supremacy and Christian fundamentalism in this country. And, you know, very soon after I arrived in the United States, because I moved here in the year 2000, and, you know, I've been a news reporter in the Middle East for over 10 years. I'm from Cairo, from Jerusalem. I grew up in Saudi Arabia, like I said. So I was very familiar with following Islamic fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism when I lived in Jerusalem. You know, and here I am in the United States. And it became very clear very soon after I arrived that Christian was the default and white was another default. And if you were a white Christian and you wanted your religion in your politics, that was perfectly fine. And if you invaded the Capitol, you know, the height, the seat of American political power, you know, holding up signs saying Jesus is our Lord and, you know, wanting to assassinate the vice president. So wanting to assassinate the second most powerful person in the US and the third, Nancy Pelosi. But because you're Christian and you're white, it was perfectly okay. Some of them were calling themselves revolutionaries. Who went to their home and ask them, do you know anyone who celebrated January 6th? Who was insisting that they submit to a special registration where they are fingerprinted and photographed and they can't move house without alerting the FBI? Who, you know, who indoctrinated them and made them into these radicals? And who is apologizing to the rest of us for the terror that they subjected us to? So clearly, there are not just double standards, there are triple and quadruple standards in the United States, depending on your religion, your ethnic background, your gender, your class, your ableism, your sexuality, your gender, so much. And January 6th, I mean, if the election of Donald Trump was a reminder, because Donald Trump is not an aberration. This is why, thank you for reminding us of Alabama, Melissa, and the church bombings by white supremacists, and the internment of Japanese Americans in concentration camps. This is white supremacy at work. And white supremacy is the reason that Donald Trump was elected, and white supremacy is the reason that my brother's mosque was set on fire, and white supremacy and its terrorism is the reason that the insurrection on January 6th has not had as massive a consequence on the evangelical community as 9/11 had on the Muslim community. And additionally, I want to remind people that COVID-19 has killed more Americans than 9/11 had. And I hold Donald Trump and Fox News and all of those other propaganda outlets directly responsible for a form of genocide that has disproportionately affected Black, Indigenous, Brown, and disabled and working class Americans. And yet, who has been held accountable to that? Multiple times Americans have been killed because of COVID than they were on 9/11. This is not to excuse or diminish 9/11, but this is to remind people that white supremacy gets away with multiple crimes, and it's time to hold it accountable.
Mona's discussion of this political double standard, which renders Muslim communities as permanent outsiders, made me curious about Amani's decision to run for Congress back in 2020. I asked her about how she reconciled her experiences of being treated as a second-class citizen with her desire to serve as an elected representative. Apparently, the question touched a point of pain.
Thanks, Melissa, for driving home the crisis that has completely fueled my inner turmoil with this entire experience with running for office. And it's a conversation that I've had with so many of my peers and colleagues, right? I mean, the whole reason why I was inspired to run for office at such a young age was because I got to see visible examples in Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and in Ilhan Omar, and that was possible, you know? And I think that their work is necessary, but one of the political experiences that actually defined my approach to social justice early on was that immediately after college, before I really focused on Muslim Girl as a platform, I actually moved straight to Washington, D.C., and I started working for a civil rights organization there. And while I was there, you know, this young, fresh-spirited person ready to change America and stuff like that, that year was actually one of the biggest controversies that hit the Muslim American community, which was when President Barack Obama invited Muslims for the national iftar at the White House in the midst of Gaza being bombed. And that, I think that really brought to light that fragmentation within our community, because then you saw half of our community, you know, the institutional leaders were inside the walls of the White House, rubbing shoulders with the president and the administration. And then you saw the other half of the community, the activists, protesting at the picket with the picket signs outside of the fence, you know, demanding the change to actually happen that we weren't seeing. And so witnessing that conflict early on, I think that was what really solidified my departure from Washington right after college, because I was like, what will make me more effective? To be another body on the ground, or to amplify or to create a platform where we can amplify thousands, if not millions, of voices like mine, and we can really be a force. And then, of course, you know, that has been a constantly evolving, again, inner conflict for me over the years. It resulted in me last year witnessing my mom get COVID in the midst of our government's sheer just incapability of addressing this crisis that we were in. And I felt like the only way that I could really push back was to take take the bull by the horns myself, you know, and run against an incumbent that's been in his seat for my entire lifetime, an old white guy that has been not representing my community or my voice for the longest time in my entire life. And so, you know, I think that now I'm kind of in a place where I feel like we need people at every level. You know, what we're going up against right now is just so severe that, you know, the folks on the inside of the White House wouldn't have had any type of power if not for the protesters on the outside of the White House pushing for that change. And similarly, the people on the outside might not have had that communication factor if not for the members of our community that were inside those walls and being able to make that engagement happen. So I think that it definitely goes both ways. And this isn't a new conversation whatsoever. I think this is something that has plagued so many minority communities that have had fights that they've had to fight against adversity. And we're all still trying to figure that out. But I think that, of course, you know, the idea is that we really have to dismantle the system in place that is oppressing us in the first place. And right now, as we witness the people coming on social media and coming online, getting younger and younger by the day, you see that people are recognizing that the system that we have, especially our justice system, it wasn't made for so many of us. And in that way, you know, it does bring into question, where is our place in the system? And can the system even exist in the future moving forward?
Thank you to Amani Akataba, founder of MuslimGirl.com, and Mona Eltahawe, writer of the Feminist Giant newsletter. You can see our entire Takeaway Live conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway. And that's all we have for you today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.